Richard Langston is on the panel, the poet and the journalist, with Steve McCabe, the teacher and the physicist. I always think of you as a physicist. Is that strictly accurate?
It's close enough.
All right. Sounds good. Always sounds good, physicist.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Nobel Committee did forget me again this year. I'm very, very disappointed.
I know. Well, the same thing happened with the man Booker and Richard Langston, but he doesn't like to talk about it.
Well, Steve might be able to split the atom, but I can split infinitives.
Can you split hairs?
Oh, yes, a pedant.
Yeah, no, yes. We can all do that on this hour.
Yes.
Now, you've had a sad school holidays, I understand, Steve McCabe. You spent them on your own.
Oh, it was awfully quiet. My girls went back to the United States for a couple of weeks. I declined to go. The thought of spending 3 weeks with the mother-in-law probably wasn't really, you know, going to do it for me. So I had the house to myself, and it was lovely. You get to do all those things that you wouldn't do when the family are around. You know, play the music as loud as you want, cook whatever you want for dinner. And I watched a lot of James Bond films in honour of the 50th anniversary. It was great fun. Absolutely fantastic. We went back to the girls weren't there. Went back to the very, very beginning, went back to the old Sean Connery stuff, and I'd forgotten just how magnificent he was.
Mm. I like the royal we here.
Oh, yes.
We went back.
Yes, me and the dog. The dog was there next to me.
So the thing is, you always say you'll get around to doing all the things you don't normally get around to, but it ends up being watching James Bond movies.
Oh, that was as good as it got.
And takeaway dinners, doesn't it?
In the evenings, yeah, when the entire day had been spent doing some serious procrastinating and you're exhausted from it, you sit down with a bit of Dr. No and you just can't beat it, can you?
And then procrastinate some more.
Oh, yeah. In the end, to be fair, what broke me out of it was watching, what was it called? Live and Let Die. Roger Moore, and by the end of it, I was just angry.
What, about the fact that Roger Moore was James Bond?
Yeah, just at how bad it was. It was so bad. You know, the film starts off with a funeral sequence, a funeral procession in New Orleans. And then about an hour and a quarter into the film, there's a second funeral procession in New Orleans. And I was so unengaged with the film that I started noticing that the same old women were standing at the side of the road. And I paused it and went back to the start and noticed and to check this. And it was, in fact, the same scene, two takes from the same scene, that they just repurposed.
Oh, you've spoiled it for me now.
But that's how unengaged I was. And in the end, I just thought,
unengaged? No. That sounds forensic, Steve.
It does.
Oh, it was shocking.
It was forensically delving.
The film was dreadful. It was ghastly.
Okay.
And he made four of them.
Thank God you're back at school.
Oh, yes.
Richard Langston, we'll have a poem from you later.
Thank you, yes.
And what have you been up to?
Well, I went to see a bloke I haven't seen for 30 years, Jim, Billy Bragg. He played at the Wellington Opera House on Saturday, and he's just as lively, engaging and warm and funny as he ever was. He's actually a funny songwriter, and you realise that when you see him live. He's a great raconteur. I mean, if you're not a fan, you might argue he's got a limited palate musically, but he is engaging because he's now playing Woody Guthrie songs. He played that in the first half and then played his own stuff in the second half. But he writes very catchy, funny songs, actually, when you hear them again. I met him when I was a freelancing music journalist in London 30 years ago, and I remember it distinctly because he'd just put out his first EP, The Milk of Human Kindness, and I went to the small record label he'd signed to interview him, and I remember it partly because there was another character in the office, a dishevelled, sad-looking man, and I found out it was Reckless Eric. And Reckless Eric was one of my heroes because he wrote a song called Whole Wide World. I'll travel the whole wide world just to find you. So it was a lovely slice of English rock eccentrics that day, an emerging. Well, Billy's not as eccentric as Reckless Eric. Do you know his stuff at all, Jim?
No, but Billy's probably got a nicer house than Reckless Eric too.
Well, yes.
The English media are fond of looking at Billy Bragg's house and saying, oh, hasn't he done well for himself?
Really? Yeah. I never knew he had a flash house. Well, of course, his politics are very much to the left, so I imagine they like shoving that in his face.
Yeah, I think so.
The Chardonnay socialist, et cetera, et cetera. But he was out here supporting the living wage for the service workers' union. So good on him, and he still seems very genuine about that.
Richard Langston, thank you. Steve McCabe on the panel. And shortly to join us, Professor Warren Brookbanks. The family of Christy Marceau, the Auckland teenager, as we know, so sadly stabbed to death by Akshay Chand, say they'll continue with their crusade to hold judges accountable and tighten bail laws. The Marceau family have described Christy's killer's sentence as insufficient. The 19-year-old Chand was sentenced to 3-year term for the kidnapping assault at the High Court yesterday. He had previously been found not guilty of her murder, as we all know, by reason of insanity and sent to a psychiatric hospital indefinitely. After all you've probably seen or read now, would you think that it's time that judges on occasion are asked to explain themselves, not necessarily in person, if that's considered, you know, unbecoming, but in some shape or form, would you like to hear reasons given?
For me, this case drives back to after he committed the kidnapping, there was a psychiatric assessment. I want to know exactly what that psychiatric assessment said of him. It appears to have said the guy was troubled, suicidal, but not homicidal. It's such a complex case. I wonder, there's so many of these cases where there's someone who's showing, who seems to be disturbed, whether they're homicidal or suicidal, whether they should be bailed to a hostel, some special hostel where for psychiatric or people who are showing, exhibiting disturbed behaviour. Kidnapping someone, as he did, seems disturbed. The victim at that time was petrified he would get out. That seems she should have been listened to more, obviously. But in Britain, in Birmingham, they have one of these specialised bail hostels for offenders with mental disorders, and it's run by the probation service. And I wonder if we need to look at that. Blaming the judge, I don't know. You know, there's a sequence of events. You need to look at the sequence of events, I think.
The judge's hands are tied to a certain extent. Remember, in a case like this, the fellow's not yet, at least within at this point in the proceedings, he's not been convicted. So we have, unfortunately, to work under a presumption of innocence. And simply saying, but it was a very severe offence, unfortunately, then doesn't then automatically, within the context of presumption of innocence, allow a custodial remand, unfortunately. You know, he's not been found guilty. It's only an alleged offence at this point.
I know, it seems such a stark choice, though, to release him to the community or keep him in jail. I'm saying, you know, in the 90s, it all got confused, psychiatric with criminal. It all seemed to get mixed up because the psychiatric units were closed down. And it seems that we've never really resolved this issue of psychiatric patients ending up in the criminal justice system. And I just wonder whether there is a one of these hostels or something.
Okay, that's no, fair enough. That's a wider issue. Professor Warren Brookbanks, but I take your point. Let's get Professor Warren Brookbanks on because his time's limited. He's today quoted as saying the judge made an informed decision while in full possession of all the known facts and letters from both the victim and the accused, etc. Professor Warren Brookbanks, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jim.
Yes, this is interesting. I mean, do you think we are just failing to understand the finer points of the law when we think that the judge had more discretion?
Well, I mean, the problem is that bail decisions, like so many decisions that courts have to make, are not bright-line judgments. I mean, it would be nice if they were, but we give judges discretion because we assume that with their legal training, their human intuition, their general sense of humanity, and given an appropriate set of information, that they can make the right decision in a particular case. And the whole operation of a law depends on that granting that sort of discretion to judges. Bail is an extremely difficult one because what you are wanting the judge to do is to make a predictive assessment of what the person is or is not likely to do up front, and then make the difficult binary decision, as you say, of bail or no bail. And if it's no bail, the only option at the present time is custody. And the problem in this case with young people generally is that the Bail Act itself is quite prescriptive, and it says that where the person is between the ages of 17 and 20, the court must give them bail unless they fall within one of the exceptions in the statute. And I don't think in this case the offender did. So that's why I said in my report that it seems that the judge may have had no other option.
And yet, you know, people, I know it's after the event, but people would think that no bail is a no-brainer when a young woman, you know, is made to strip at knife point in grave and realistic fear of her life and makes this very clear in her submission to the court. People must be scratching their heads. I mean, it's obvious they are, Warren, all over New Zealand.
Look, I entirely agree, and it's quite likely that other judges faced with the same set of facts may well have made a decision the other way. But, you know, a judge has the discretion, and One hopes that in each case it's based on a careful examination of the evidence which is placed before them. But then again, it is a human and subjective call. It's informed, but it's based on a human judgment, and they're not infallible.
No, of course not. But are they constrained by protocols? Are you implying that also applies in this case? That there is a set of points to consider in decision making, which may be overly constraining.
Well, the Bail Act is a statutory code, and the judges must operate within the parameters of the Act. And where the Act says, if the person is between 17 and 20, you must grant them bail, the judge doesn't have any option. And that's the whole point about a code. It's to prescribe a particular course of action that must be followed in every case. Now, here, of course, the option would have been placing them in custody, but then in the circumstances, there would have to be very powerful reasons why that was necessary, as opposed to giving bail but making it subject to very strong conditions in light of the fact that there is a presumption favouring bail for young people. So those are all the things that have got to be brought into the mix in making that decision.
It does raise the question, though, even though strict bail conditions were imposed here by the judge, but what follow-up is there to ensure that those bail conditions are met? Does a probation officer, does someone check?
Yes, look, that's a very good point, and that may well be where there is a weakness in the legislation, that it's all very well imposing conditions, but who's going to ensure that they're enforced? And I don't think in this case there was such follow-up, as far as I'm aware.
Well, that's hopeless, isn't it?
He was simply given a curfew,
yeah.
and made subject to certain conditions.
Yeah, a clear direction that he was not to associate with the young woman, and clearly he's just breached
that. Because he hadn't been convicted of any offence.
Well, that's hopeless. It's just really hopeless.
So that may be where, in the light of this case and a review of the legislation, that some work needs to be done. I agree with that.
So who could? A probation officer? But you're saying he's not on probation, so
he's not on probation. It would have to be some other statutory officer who had the authority to oversee the observance of bail conditions.
Because
that would be a new person, a new sort of animal, I guess.
Yeah, because my understanding is he went to live with his family, didn't he?
He was with his mother, and he may have gone after the first bail hearing. He may have gone to live with his aunt. I'm not entirely sure of the sequence of events, but the only people around him were his aunt, his mother, and his sister, as I understand it.
And he'll be able to manipulate all those people, I'm sure. And if there's no third party checking on him, you might as well not impose any conditions whatsoever on him.
Well, that's a call, I guess.
Well, the conditions are a bit meaningless anyway, because, you know, we've got the fellow who's accused, at least. I mean, we're kind of working on the assumption he probably must have done it, that's why he's being accused, of these very violent crimes against this young lady, and then there's a clear direction he's not to associate with her. But there was a clear direction. He wasn't supposed to kidnap her and assault her either.
Of
so clearly
course.
He's not overly impressed by these clear directions.
No. Well, I mean, you know, this is the problem. A lot of legislation sets up prescriptive requirements, but sometimes they're not backed up with realistic sanctions, and this may be one area.
Given the seriousness of what occurred here, and I'm just wondering, Warren, getting back to Richard Langston's earlier point, where public interest is this high, is it appropriate in certain circumstances for the public to be made available of the information that the judge was privy to?
Well, I would be reluctant to see that happen before the event, because there's a real danger in allowing public sentiment to influence judicial decision making. I mean, it happens to a certain extent. Judges are themselves members of the public, but in making decisions like this, the information ought to be information which is privileged, at least in the first instance, so that the judge can make a proper and unbiased or uninterested decision about the case before him or her. If the public were given the right to have any influence on that decision, then it could become a bit of a circus, I think. I think there've got to be rules around what sort of information is made available and who sees it in the first instance. And of course, here, what's happened that now that the case has been decided, there's a lot more information coming out that wasn't available to the public when the matter was first before the court.
But even if we do make it public, then what? Are we going to have public referenda second guessing judges?
No, no, but in terms of what we would like to know now, it might also obviate the cynicism that is obviously in the country, in certain quarters, about what about the quality of the safe of the state safeguarding of the life of Christy Marceau.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there's all things, all kinds of things you can do by way of public education, advising people of the legal requirements around bail and things like that, and that may satisfy some people. But what we are dealing with here at the end of the day, Jim, is a terrible, terrible crime where an innocent and beautiful young woman's life was taken, and that creates a raw nerve for anybody with half a sense of compassion. Nobody wants that sort of thing to happen. But tragically, in the society in which we live, we don't have firewalls to protect us against those sorts of things. And unfortunately, in the nature of things, similar things are going to happen in the future. All we can do is try and ensure that the legislation that we do have in place is able to protect people to the best of its ability. And if it's not working, then we tweak it by legislative amendment to make it work better. But it'll never be perfect.
Yeah, but it seems to me we left... There's a huge gap there. And that young woman and her family was let down by the fact there was no follow-up. OK, impose bail conditions and then do nothing to ensure they are imposed.
That may well be the gravamen of the whole problem here.
It just seems blatantly obvious.
Yeah.
You shouldn't... Oh, I don't know. You can't bail someone if they're that dangerous.
Well, of course,
and disturbed.
And that's the problem. That at that point, nobody knew how dangerous he really was.
Well,
he was in a deteriorating mental state.
If we extend some compassion to him as well, and I know it's difficult in the circumstances, but he was suicidal. Doesn't that suggest he should be bailed possibly to a psychiatric institute, not to the community? That seems to me the nub of it.
Well, that was an option under the Act. You know, the Act where a person is being considered for psychiatric assessment, there are three alternatives. They can be bailed to the community, they can be bailed, they can be detained in prison and have the assessment done there, or they can be remanded to a psychiatric institution for an assessment to take place during that initial remand period. And of course, in the first instance, he was remanded to prison and the assessment took place there, but then there was a further bail hearing once the court had information about his psychiatric state before it. Mm-hmm. And it was on that basis that the second bail decision was made.
Okay.
All right, thank you very much, Warren. Professor Warren Brookbanks on the panel. 25 minutes past 4 o'clock with Steve and Richard. Now, Google shares. Can we talk about that?
Why not?
Google shares suspended today because we want to find out what this means in terms of faith in Wall Street's faith in the whole tech market as well. Google shares suspended today after the accidental announcement of this 20% profit drop against the previous year. The company's shares dropped 9.03% before the suspension kicked in.
How cynical are we allowed to be here?
You'd be as cynical as you want.
Right, here's a cynical reading. It says it was suspended after an accidental early release of a filing. And it couldn't possibly be that this filing was leaked in order to get the shares suspended to avoid trading, which would have seen the share price plummet. Couldn't possibly be that, could it?
I couldn't possibly say.
No, no.
You're the expert.
I'm an expert on Google, not on the business thereof. But no. That's a cynical take on it.
Mm. Well, they bought Motorola, and that seems to have caused a problem, doesn't it? The cell phone company. They bought it to buy its treasure trove of patents to fight Apple, didn't they? And but the company seems a bit of a lemon apart from that, and it's led to, what, $500 million loss? And that seems to be their problem.
Yeah, so there's not as much money delivering ads to mobiles as there is in serving ads to personal computers?
Apparently not, no. And as the market is starting to shift more and more toward mobile searches rather than toward desktop searches, they're seeing that they're actually doing, in some ways you can say that they're doing more work for less money. But, I mean, to be fair, Google ultimately have no actual tangible product.
They do, I've seen. They've got all these warehouses full of beautiful coloured hard drives and computers, and they're massive warehouses, and some arty photographers taking pictures of them, and you can see them on the web if you Google them.
Aha. So it's a wonderfully recursive bit of logic there, isn't it?
Yes, it's marvellous. Well, I'm so dumb about computers and the internet and what it actually is physically. When Apple informed us that we could store stuff on a cloud, my brain went no further than imagining all my music was somehow floating in nimbus and
being played on harps.
Yes.
And you started thinking about listening to songs like Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head.
Yeah, but there's great warehouses in suburbia where all our guff is stored.
Data centres, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the thing is, what they're storing there is your data. Or in other words, basically, an abstraction of you, because you are the product, really.
Scary.
A cloud sounds better than we're storing all your data in.
Well, it does.
In a grimy industrial room.
Yes, your data, your third song there is on the outskirts of LA in a rather dull, warehouse.
It does take the romance out of it, doesn't it?
It does, and so I like to think of the cloud. I was a bit shattered. It was a bit like finding out that Santa... Oh, I can't say that. Doesn't exist.
It doesn't? Where's not so?
All right, seeing as you're with us, Steve McCabe, where's Larry?
Where's Larry? Well, he's not emailed me in ages, so I've got no idea.
He seems to be... He was off the scene for a while, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, people are wondering all about Google, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, one thing that we have to say about Google, and I think it's true about Facebook as well, is they were started up by tech geniuses. You've got Larry Page and Sergey Brin over at Google. You've got Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook. And these were fellows who came up with fantastic technologies. They were very, very good at building something. And they've come up with one product each, basically. And what we now do, especially with this is the case with Mark Zuckerberg, but I think it's also true with Google, is we now count out them constantly and we say that anything that they do is automatically going to be an inspired stroke of business and computing genius. And I'm thinking, well, no, not necessarily. They got lucky once. They don't have a consistent track record. They've got one thing that they've flogged to death for a long time. Google are actually done very, very well from it. But Google have done very well in recruiting engineers. I don't think that Brin and Page on their own would have been able to build the company the way they did.
How significant do you think, just finally, is the 20% profit drop? I mean, how would you characterise it? Is it dismaying for the future of, for example, tech startups, faith in the industry, etc., blah, blah, or are you not that bothered?
Look at the size of the net profit that we're talking about.
Yes, yeah, billions.
They've gone down from 2.75 to 2.25 billion. Oh, my heart bleeds.
I know. 11.9 billion they were expected to make, and they only made 11.3. What failures. Okay. Stand at the back of the room in the dunce's corner.
Exactly. Google. Just give it up and go home at this point, right? I mean, Sergey Brin might have to sell his 757 back. Honestly, there you go.
Okay.
Hell in a handbasket.
Steve McCabe, Richard Langston on the panel.